podcast hosted by the Association for Women in Cryptocurrency, sponsored by Bracewell LLP. Bracewell is a leading law and government relations firm whose award-winning teams lead the market in cutting-edge transactions and litigation, regulatory matters, and government relations. You can learn more at bracewell.com. Today's topic is decrypting risks in DeFi. Anything and everything you would want to know about the industry, risks in decentralized finance, and why it's so important. The Association is a global professional network of women and supportive allies around the world who advocate for the equitable inclusion of women in the future of digital finance, blockchain technology, and Web3. The views of the speakers are their own and do not necessarily represent those of their employers, the association, its sponsors, or its board of directors. This podcast is our opportunity to showcase the incredible work being done by our members around the world in the crypto, blockchain, and Web3 industries. I'm your host, Amanda Wick, founder and CEO of the Association for Women in Cryptocurrency. Carol House is the executive in residence at Terranet Ventures. She is a non-resident senior fellow at the Atlantic Council Geoeconomic Center. She recently served as the director for cybersecurity and secure digital innovation for the White House National Security Council. Carol joined the NSC from the U.S. Treasury's Financial Crimes Enforcement Network, also called FinCEN, where she led cybersecurity, virtual currency, and emerging technology policy efforts as a senior cyber and emerging technology policy officer. Jessica Rainier is managing director and head of digital finance at the Institute of International Finance. She previously served as program associate director at the Office of Management and Budget in the Executive Office of the President. Before this, she was senior counselor for terrorist financing and financial crimes, as well as senior advisor for domestic finance at the U.S. Department of the Treasury, where she led financial technology and innovation policy. Trust me when I say that those are the short versions of these two women's bios, and we are incredibly excited to have two not just fantastic subject matter experts, but wonderful humans on the podcast today. Very valuable at helping the government and advising the government. And I'll leave it at that, specifically committees run by the CFTC. And Carol, you recently worked on and came out with a report on decentralized finance that I feel is a must read for anyone in the policy space. And there was a lot in that. And it's a really good opportunity for us to talk with you and Jess about the risks in DeFi, the opportunities in DeFi, and how we balance that. So this is an educational program. We kind of like to start because we don't like to presume what folks know. Can we start with like a level setting in terms of how would you guys define DeFi? Because I think that's probably the first problem. I know if you define this, it's kind of like that could be a book in and of itself. But let's just start with that. There's no right or wrong answer. Maybe that is the problem, but let's just try to get a definition on the table that we can work with going forward.
Oh, that's such an interesting question to start off with. I'm like, oh, this is easy, except that it's not. And that's absolutely what we found in the effort in the DeFi report, because our objective number one was to try to find what was this and coalesce around this definition. And I actually have some personal views where I go back and forth on sometimes thinking that definitions aren't important at all, because sometimes fighting over definitions results in paralysis of any action. And it's just so frustrating. I'd rather spend time doing action. But then on the other side, I recognize, no, definitions are extremely important. Otherwise, we're not talking about the same thing. To banks, like Coinbase may be DeFi, but to anyone in crypto, including Coinbase, Coinbase is not DeFi. So the like understanding and making sure that what we are at least level setting and starting from the same base of understanding is really critical. So in the DeFi report, we highlighted this fundamental challenge on trying to define what is DeFi. We did present a functional definition and then proceeded to examine how that's not in practical reality, how a lot of things in DeFi are functioning. But the definition that we outlined, which is really more aspirational, is a definition that we highlighted the fact that these are highly automated financial networks that do not have a single point of failure or a single point of authority that is able to do things like censor or assert control over the ledger or the record of activity on its own without having to work across a very decentralized network of other entities with points of control and authority in order to deliver or provide one or more types of financial services. So that was the definition that we came up with. Again, I think part of what we highlighted in the report was that a lot of things that say that they don't have a central authority, that there is therefore nothing to be able to wrap your arms around or potentially be able to regulate. We highlighted that DeFi and decentralization is really on a spectrum. These are not binary, like zeros or ones, yes or no's on being decentralized. You exist on this spectrum, and the decentralization exists across several different functions. We outlined different functional and technological areas and dimensions, like things like access and governance and development all being different aspects of those dimensions. So if you think about it being on a spectrum and that each of those dimensions is a different axis, you have a very, very multidimensional ecosystem of DeFi applications that might be very centralized in access, but actually very decentralized in governance. So I guess highlighting like there is no specific definition for like, this is where you are decentralized enough that you are definitely DeFi. And here's what that specific implementation looks like versus if you're centralized in this way, then you're centralized enough to be covered. That was a challenge that we came across, why we highlighted that our definition probably won't make it into any laws as being the definition of, well, here's where you're regulated if you fit this particular parameter. But anyway, so we did try to define it, but also highlight the challenges with defining it. It was a really interesting exercise with a fantastic group on the Tech Advisory Committee.
After that, I hate to ask Jess anything to add to the definition of DeFi. I would definitely give you the opportunity, especially coming from more TradFi space, if there's aspects of the definition that you would add to that.
Yeah, absolutely. And just for those who aren't as familiar with the IIF, we're the trade association of the global financial industry. So I talk with north of 400 financial institutions, whether they be banks or insurance companies, exchanges, central banks, the sovereign wealth funds, et cetera, around the world across about 70 different countries, you know, every week. So with that background, I agree with Carol on much of what she said in terms of the difficulty of landing on a specific definition. But what I really think about is much of the dialogue focuses on an entity definition of you are either DeFi entity or you are not a DeFi entity. And financial services, we look at activity-based regulation and we look at entity-based regulation a lot of times. But then if you look at both of those things, that doesn't actually land on, I think, what's actually being discussed most of the time, which is a process that is being conducted. I think about DeFi much more as a question of how decentralized is a given process that an entity is executing. And that's where the continuum lies along which decentralization may exist, is that you don't have to have an entity where you can say this entity is wholly decentralized. There is no centralized aspect to how this place operates. But you can have processes that may run in a more decentralized manner or a more automated manner than they have to date or historically. And I think therein lies the issue is that too much of the discussion is focused on how do we just fit this into this is an activity that you're doing or this is an entity, as opposed to just saying there are processes, and oftentimes technology causes us to reconsider how we run those processes. And they may be more in one direction or less in one direction. So I think that that's really where we're challenged to try to define this, because we're trying to define something kind of with a false equivalent.
I know, right? And I think what's really cool about that is that, tell me if I'm wrong, but I think that means that TradFi could have some DeFi to it that a lot of folks don't realize, right? They could be decentralizing their processes. I think people think DeFi, they think the DeGen community and developers, and these are the only people doing decentralized protocols and decentralized apps and like to your point, entities and projects and not necessarily the processes and the way that you laid it out. So do you see people kind of not realize how much TradFi is looking at decentralizing processes and kind of getting into the decentralized space and having stake in the DeFi game?
Absolutely. I think it is quite inaccurate to imagine that folks who kind of characterize themselves as being in DeFi are not people who have anything to do with traditional financial institutions. Now, that's not to say that like a bank is suddenly going to become a decentralized entity. It's a bank. It is a centralized operational entity, right? But it may look to conduct some of its processes again in a more decentralized manner than it has to date, because it may find something more efficient in doing so. And some of the innovations in technology are allowing a lot of these institutions to realize some of those efficiencies, or at least explore them and do experiments with them. And there is a lot of thought being put into this space. So I kind of gave the background of the IIF to help understand like my remarks, because that is the majority of kind of entities that I talk to on a daily basis. And I can tell you the amount of time that they are putting thoughtful, not just thoughtful time, but investment into exploring how they may take advantageous aspects of a technology to pursue something that may be more decentralized and thus serve the consumer better or even mitigate risk better in a particular way. Now, that doesn't by any means mean that they're fully like, let's go decentralize everything, because I mean, that would be crazy. They are centralized entities, right? But they're, you don't have to be this binary zero or one game. And I think actually trying to be, as Carol mentioned, trying to go all the way over to one direction, right? I think that it's actually rare that you get to an outcome where you're just truly like, I have no accountability. There is absolutely nothing centralized here. Nobody's in charge of anything. Like that's just not how we operate as a society. And so I do think that, you know, you can see in all of the time that financial institutions have put into very thoughtful responses to consultations on decentralized finance. For instance, IOSCO's consultation on DeFi. We turned in a formal submission to that. That is, I don't even know, I think like 30 pages of extremely thoughtful, well out negotiated language. And none of that language says anything around like competition, like, hey, DeFi people, stop, you know, stop competing with centralized entities or something. None of it is focused on that, on this like false, like entity issue. It's all focused on where processes may benefit from aspects of decentralized finance and where accountability still needs to exist. Right? Because there just isn't an excuse to say we're completely decentralized and thus no accountability needs to follow. And the last thing I'd say is I would really point to really cool projects that some jurisdictions are doing, like MAS and its Project Guardian, and some of the banks that are very involved in experimenting around applications that absolutely are DeFi. I mean, the OECD has done a lot of research and publications on institutional DeFi. That's traditional finance right there.
Yeah, I love the fossil equivalency point. And I just, in a different vein on like, since you mentioned in TradFi, Amanda, I thought you would laugh at this, and actually both of you would, since you come from the regulatory and law enforcement and ill backgrounds. I had a discussion once when I was trying to talk with some DeFi people about like, about the spectrum of centralization and highlighting that part of TradFi is also regulators and the government. And trying to describe how the government sits on the centralization spectrum and like talking about the Hill and how every member is like its own microcosm of the US government and an agency, and how that is like it's not fully centralized, right? Like we're not that autocracy. So there is decentralization in government in the Fed. I'm not saying that it is on the decentralized part of the spectrum. I'm just saying that it's not at its fullest extreme. Like it is slightly away from completely centralized. We do have different branches. We do have regulators that have independent authorities, and the White House doesn't get to tell what to do and don't have to listen to each other. Now they do, they work together nicely, but like highlighting that like even the government is decentralized to an extent, like on this spectrum.
I don't think people realize that. I certainly didn't when I went to go on the Hill, that each of those little offices is like a fiefdom. It like has its own budget. It's a very strange system. I think frankly more people should learn about how our government works. It would horrify them. But I say that to say that I think one of the cool things that both of you guys say, that if I could pick out, like, there's a little bit of a difficulty in that historically we like definitions, right? Carol, to your point, like we like to define things, and regulations, lawyers especially, as a recovering lawyer, I say like lawyers especially love to kind of say, well, you need definitions because you need clarity, right? And something has to be defined if you're going to regulate it. And like just taking, for example, you were at FinCEN for a long time, the question of what constitutes a money services business, right? And there's this. And if you do these things, you're a money services business. But it's difficult to regulate something. Like how do you set a regulatory perimeter for something like DeFi, given its squishiness, if it's on a spectrum? Because we historically have not done a good job at regulating processes. Now, I will say activity we have. Right. Like in the sense that if you look at the definition of money services business, thanks to some really brilliant people, I think at FinCEN and the guidances that they've released, which activities constituted money services businesses, right? We were able to regulate. And then you saw that statute and the guidances as a result accommodating when it went from your traditional kind of Western Union to a Hawalador, and then not having to be so stuck in titles, because if the activity was the transfer of value, right, to another personal location, to Jess's point, we were looking at activities or processes and not entities and names, right? We were looking at like, what are you doing? But it's hard if you have a spectrum of what you're doing. So how do we set a regulatory perimeter for something that's so squishy?
Yeah. And I think you've driven a scalpel right into the true heart of the issue. And for years, I remember at FinCEN and elsewhere, like highlighting that the biggest issue isn't the definition of money services business and including money transmission to include value substituting for currency, which was driven by some brilliant people that saw the future back in 2011 when that rulemaking came out. And I was not there, but those were the people that inspired me to change my whole life and go from hard cyber into money, then hunting down cyber criminals, because they could see the future and what was coming. And that definition is brilliant, right? Like, because of its tech neutrality and it just saying value substituting for currency. I remember once someone saying, well, that's too vague. You know, we don't want to cover shells and beads. And I was like, of course we do. Absolutely, I do.
If shells and beads are paying for terrorist missiles, I want to cover shells and beads.
Exactly. When I 3D print figurines of Amanda Wick, my plan for future world domination, and convince people to use that in exchange for goods and services, like, I want that to be covered for money transmission purposes, because that is the point of the anti-money laundering regulation. I want to cover where either like money or value substituting for money for currency is being used in that sort of function and transfer of value. But writing the policy to cover that definition is very different from driving compliance and enforcing that compliance. And so really it's that, like, getting the policy right, which can still be hard. And I'm thrilled that there were people that were smart enough to see the need for that kind of broad terminology back then. And not having that broad terminology is why other jurisdictions have been behind on trying to update like legislative frameworks and things where they only had authorities to cover legal tender activity. But ultimately enforcing it is where the toughness comes in. And this problem of trying to define this regulatory perimeter in a way where industry feels confident in their coverage, and that their confidence should be driven by an earnest desire to understand how they fit, which does not demonstrate how the crypto industry has always behaved or how all of it still does. Not all of them earnestly want to understand that they may or may not be money transmitters, but many now especially do. And the conversation really has evolved a lot, but it takes that. And it also takes enforcement and guidance and a variety of lots of things to emphasize, like, what is the practical reality? The toughness with crypto, where it's essentially arbitrary to write a few lines of code and launch thousands of these assets, right? Like, then when it takes a regulatory determination, asset by asset, facts and circumstance by facts and circumstance, for determinations, let's say, for whether something is a security or a commodity, you get the problem of scalability of application case by case when industry doesn't just accept that they are or understand where they fit underneath this, whether driven by clarity or driven by like reality of likely enforcement related to that application. So this issue of drawing the regulatory perimeter, it's tough when I feel like governments don't have much of an incentive to create this arbitrage line. I would say industry would call it the clarity line and government would call it an arbitrage line for saying here, if you are here and you are decentralized enough on one side, you are not therefore regulated or an entity or a person, that everything is actually about personhood and whether or not you fit underneath this definition, because the activity might be happening, but we cover the activity based on the persons who conduct the activity. That's who gets regulated. Ultimately, I think that it's going to be tough since, like I mentioned, you can be highly decentralized in one dimension, like access, and maybe not in governance or development. So what does it mean when there's so many different dimensions? And it might end up being kind of like tiered or gatewayed, but then it also means an overlapping system where you have other layers of the DeFi stack, where it's not just relying on where like exchanges and applications are sitting, but looking elsewhere and where maybe more centralized entities do exist, like perhaps at the network layer or going all the way to very decentralized, but going to end user. End user presents interesting other problems, but like we do have end user based regulatory regimes. The tax framework is an example of that. So basically there's options for where you can put that regulatory perimeter. A lot would go into deciding where that should sit, but I'll stop talking from there. But I just wanted to highlight some of the challenges that we sort of faced on trying to figure out how to most effectively regulate something. For now, at least, a lot of things that claim to be really decentralized are not. So the argument for entityhood can be pretty strong in a lot of things that have claimed to be DeFi. But decentralization is growing, and that is part of the future as it appears here.
I think the problem that I have is the lack of objectivity and nuance and the ability to have the discussions about this in the sense, and maybe Jess, it was something that you said a while ago, where it's like, there are no things that are black and white. There are just so, like, binary is such a basic thing that just doesn't really apply to anything anymore, right? Like, it's just very difficult to find something that isn't gray, that isn't on a spectrum, that doesn't require kind of like an adaptation and a willingness to deal with change. And I think my frustration has been on both sides. I think if, you know, Carol and I have had long conversations about this, but it feels like there's a problem on the industry side, and then there's a problem on the regulator side, right? And we say regulator, but I wish, you know, people can't see it, see my air quotes, but I will say there's like a, people don't realize there's a political level to government agencies, and then there's a career level to government agencies, the people who are doing the work, making the analysis, making the suggestions year after year, saying this is what we should do. And then somebody who comes in with an administration who says, yeah, we're not going to do that, makes a bunch of decisions, changes the world, and then like goes on to their next job when the administration changes. One of the things that I would love to get your thoughts about, Carol, there's a part in the paper that I was kind of obsessed with, which is you give this beautiful equation for assessing risk, which is risk equals threat times probability times impact minus mitigation. And I was having a conversation yesterday with someone at an event who does litigation for the Bitcoin Legal Defense Fund. And it was, you know, they sent on a panel, code is speech, and speech is code. And I was like, wow, but see, the problem is like code that takes actions is a little bit different, right? And I think one of my frustrations as a former prosecutor, and Janisha and I were joking about this because she's a, you know, former financial crime investigator, is I think a lot of the developers who make these things sit in a room with good hearts, good minds, and think, oh, look, this has such positive implications for privacy. And there are some people in the world who would really benefit from privacy. And so they're seeing the impact, right? The positive impact. And because they weren't prosecutors, spending years in the bowels of humanity and watching the horrible things that humans do to each other, their threat assessment and probability assessment matrix isn't necessarily the same as those of us. But how do we have the conversation with like the developer community and the trade associations and everybody building these things to say, you guys are brilliant and a lot of you have good hearts. And that's exactly how Pandora's box got invented and opened, is that if you don't even know how to assess humanity properly, if you're not looking at threats and probabilities, you can't possibly, you have no idea the risk of what you're unleashing in the world with these things. And I find that's a struggle. And I don't know if you guys encounter this struggle or see it, but
as one of those political people that came in, not as a career, who came in at a high level and just kind of swept through without having lived in the bowels of the federal agency for a really long time, there are a lot of political people who come into that position who have worked in the financial industry for a long time, right? Who have experience of how processes inside of a bank or an insurance company actually work, not theoretically how some policymakers once thought they might work in an economic paper, right? And who have looked at it only from the regulator side that has an endless P&L funded by the government to exist for as long as they want without having to necessarily be accountable to a budget. And on that, there can be a whole lot of benefit to having people, obviously the right people, because some people do drop in, they're not necessarily well equipped for their job. They drop in, they do the job for a year, change the world and move on. And I don't even know what they, you know, they may go into something else that has nothing to do with that anymore. But from my experience, coming in with real practical knowledge of the industry that you're about to try to have an effect on, and then having the ability to come in and interpret what the fantastic career civil servants have done for a long time and connect it to the reality of the industry and then move back out. And many of the civil servants have also been in industry before, right? And then move on and then continue to help the government talk with the private sector on the backside, like a trade association, like the IAF does on a daily basis, has enormous like positive impact.
You're 100% right. And it's a fair call out. And I'll tell you, you know, what's interesting about that is You're right, because, and I will tell you, it's a bias that you're 100% correct, that if you're a career that has a negative experience with your political, you look at things a certain way. To your point, politicals came in, moved things, had business experience. Like, there was a huge value where some people I know, they're like, I can't believe I'm saying this because politically I have a different view. But I mourn the days where the Trump administration people were the politicals at these agencies moving things and getting things done. And I don't think people realize that the ramifications of elections at that level, where who gets put into those, to your point, who gets put into those political positions matters so much, because you make such a good point. And I'm really glad you called it out, because you could have a negative experience like me with people who don't do anything and just sit there, and all the careers are like, but we have spent so many years, we want to do these things. And then you can have people who come in and actually move things. And so the quality and the who of who gets put into those political positions, you're right. Because of that, it matters so much. And I appreciate that call out. Carol, I can see you itching to say something.
I know, because I love this so much, especially for both of you, since I have no idea what the rest of your aspirations are, but I hope to see both of you in very senior political positions at some point in the future in the government. And I know, Jess, you already have those.
I'm pretty sure comments I have made that impossible, but I love your optimism.
Yeah, I have my own like plan, like as I huddle away to the risk board that I totally don't have in my gaming room of like what government I one day hope exists. And Jess is so especially special, because there's just not many people. First off, she's also a very senior reserve officer. So like Kate, like not only has the incredible industry experience, including like standing up a huge part of the blockchain practice for the largest consulting firm in the world, so therefore consulted like most giant companies about how to deal with emerging tech, but then direct work in finance and then working in on the executive branch side at very senior levels and at trade associations. She's been everywhere. And then Amanda, like most people, certainly not prosecutors, end up on the Hill, like with the experience that you've got either. So like, honestly, like it's wonderful. And I have a good friend who she spent most of her time on the Hill, and she spent a brief stint at an executive agency as a political. And then I spent a brief stint over on the Hill as a detailee from the executive side. And both of us laugh at each other, because we each hate the other's branch so much. And so it's actually like and I know that this, like, thank God there's people that like to work on the Hill, because I have no intention of ever going back. They're made of sterner stuff than I. The type of patience that you have to just work forever on most legislation never going anywhere is not the kind of patience that I have. It's not, no one's ever accused me of patience being a virtue of mine. So like, it just, the executive branch is absolutely my branch through and through. But she hated the executive branch, because she's like, you have so many rules. You can't leak anything. You can't talk to anybody. You can't do stuff. And I was like, yes, this makes sense that we mutually do not like each other's branches. So we've laughed about that a lot. So thank goodness there's people that like to do those things. I totally hear you on like the fact that like everyone, it's so driven by personalities and individuals and like for who's in which roles. And then also on this dialogue issue, Amanda, that you were pointing to, having this conversation with people about the meaningful impact of what they're doing is so important not only just the fact that we're in a very tense political moment right now, we're having open, candid dialogue and discourse and disagreement, and still being able to be collegial about it on the backside of it is not an inevitability anymore. But just generally, like there's not a lot of people, like industry loves to say, oh, government needs to get educated. And I'm like, and point that back right at yourself. Like, you guys are often the ones that are not educated on the realities of the spaces that you are dealing in. And it was very telling to me, several conversations that I have had over the past many years with DeFi, where like I proposed in a speech to a sector, like it was to the crypto sector, and it was a very Bitcoin heavy crowd too, where I was like, what would it take for you guys to decide that you have shared a common value, which is maybe that like the two biggest bads, you pick what they are. I'm going to propose North Korea and CSAM, child sexual abuse material. But hey, like you pick your biggest bads. If those aren't on the list, though, I'd like to know why. But pick your biggest bads. What would it take for you guys to coalesce around sharing common value and deciding that those things suck and you don't want to validate those transfers anymore? What would it take for you guys to just do that? And let's pretend that it's not, in fact, already a legal obligation for you to comply with sanctions and not provide material support to prohibited transactions to North Korea. So let's ignore that, the fact that you might legally already be required to do this. But like, what would it take for it to be a moral calling for you guys to agree on this level? And the response that I got back, which was fascinating, was no, never. Because if you can censor a bad guy, you can censor a good guy. And I was like, and here's where the worldview departs. Here's where we disagree on things and why, like, and really it's because if you look at their background, like where they stand depends on where they sit. I remember hearing that. I'm sure that was that someone came up with that quote forever ago, and that has always stuck with me. They come from tech. They come from internet and software background and regulation area, like you said, about software being code and speech in their minds. So they want an internet type regulatory structures on the activity that they're doing, which I still feel that they're also not educated enough on what is happening in regulation of internet and technology right now. But basically, they feel that they should have the same level of privacy and undiscoverability in financial activity because they're conducting the financial activity via software. And they don't understand this fundamental issue of like the difference between value and information transfer, and why I got called a fascist and pro-censorship on that Reddit thread after that speech. So
in fairness, I think they do understand. My frustration sometimes, and this is not a political rant, this is just like a philosophical difference. But I remember having a very long conversation with a guy who identifies as libertarian, and he's really involved with one of the, I'll say, CBDC projects. And it was an interesting discussion because, to your point, it was very much like, no, I just don't think a lot of these laws should be in place. And I was like, well, how do you feel about murder? Presumably, you agree that we should have the do not murder rule. Yes. And how do you feel about the burglary law? Like, in the sense of, should I be able to come into your home and steal your things? And he was like, I'm okay with burglary. I was like, so just to be clear, you're okay with laws that protect you. And if you don't see how it benefits or protects you, those are the laws that you have an issue with. Because the problem I have is that people don't understand that all of the rule of law is a social contract that a majority presumably agrees on. And the issue that I have is that if tomorrow I wrote code that said, I'm going to crawl through all of your protocols, all of your projects, and if your security isn't good enough, my code, my smart contract is going to steal your tokens. And if you just didn't spend enough on security, if you didn't do what you should, my smart contract is geared to actually steal from you. It's not going to come back to me because it's a truly decentralized project. I set it free in the world. I want the money to go to a nonprofit. I consider myself Robina Hood. And this is my smart contract. And if it stole money from all of these protocols, and I said, but guys, code is speech. I don't know what your problem is just because it steals. Unless you want to have the real argument that you're okay with money laundering and you have a bigger problem of stealing, especially when it's stealing from you. Because then all of a sudden I have a feeling code being action will suddenly not be as okay with you when the action is taken against you, when you see the harm, when you see the threat, when all of a sudden that risk equation, you see the threat, you see the probability, you see the impact, you don't see mitigation. And then who you gonna call? A government agency that you want to mitigate it to get your stuff back. And this is my problem, is the hypocrisy of that argument and of that line of thinking of, they just don't care until it's them who are being impacted by the threat. To your point, they're not North Korean. Maybe they're not the parents of a child who's been sex trafficked, who's been put into CSAM material. Maybe they're not the parent of a victim who died in a drug deal, whose funds are then being laundered to perpetuate the drug trade. Because if it hasn't happened to them, they don't care. And that is my fundamental problem with it. And I will be honest, I had a conversation with a libertarian who was literally like, but I'd rather the country burn down as long as we're free while it burns than overly regulate for the collective good. And I'll throw a really hard question out there is, if that is where America is headed, how does that mentality win in getting business in a technology that essentially needs fit for purpose regulation for the collective good that addresses the risks realistically?
So that is a pretty big question, pretty challenging question. Maybe if I pull back to something that's tangible, a little bit less violent, perhaps, but to something that's tangible, and think back to kind of the concept of, if you don't have context for appreciating the value of certain ways in which we operate today, then it's tough to want to operate that way. Because if you're like lacking that experience or knowledge or context, it may be a reason that you have that approach. It may also not be. It may simply be because people can be crazy at times. But I mean, it happens. But so to bring it back to a tangible thing that we saw happen in like the last couple of years in this space. So historically, if you look at the financial industry, the entire financial industry is truly built on a function of risk management, right? Everybody in finance is a risk manager at heart. Like that might as well just be their job description because that is the business of finance, right?
Do you real quick though, do you think that's true on the sales side? Because I talk to a lot of people in compliance who say that is absolutely the mentality of people in compliance, but that is not necessarily the mentality of people on the sales profitability side of financial institutions. I know that could be its own podcast. So like, I get that.
Yeah. I mean, I could argue both sides. I could say like, do certain jobs, obviously certain jobs are more focused on risk management than others are sales jobs, whether it's in finance or in another industry as a whole, you know, is their goal to make money perhaps for themselves, for an entity or whatever? Sure. But if you also wanted to argue that, you could say, well, sales positions are also managing against the risk of not making enough revenue that their company goes under and they lose their job. Right. There's different kinds of ways in which you can evaluate that risk, and definitely investment. I mean, the entire time that you're sitting there, you're investing either on your own behalf or on behalf of your clients. You are trying to manage the risk, the downside, in order to get the upside. Right. Like that is fully what finance is about. So I think from that traditional finance kind of background, there is a whole lot of just DNA in the financial industry of managing risk. And that also includes the importance of having organizational structures that help you manage that risk. And there are functions there for a reason, right? And they appreciate and understand that reason because the DNA comes with that, because there's context and understanding of that history of how the industry works. I think what we saw over the last few years is this amazing innovation from the technology side of life, right? From the tech industry that was not necessarily the financial industry. And so the same level of DNA and history of risk management that's just like inside of somebody who has grown up in that particular space, it's not the same, right? They manage for other things and sometimes risk, but not so much financial risk. And so you have this huge infusion of the tech industry into the financial industry without necessarily that same level of DNA that says, okay, we need to risk manage in a financial capacity. And these organizational structures are absolutely needed in order to do so. And so you've seen or did see a lot of companies, earlier companies that got really popular. I mean, FTX is a perfect example, right? Where there's no organizational structure around a company that is valued, you know, is supposedly valued at such a high valuation. And you look and you say, where is the board? Where is the C-suite? Where is anybody else to help manage this entity, right? And that's just the most kind of public, obvious one that probably a lot of people come to mind. But that has been evident across the board in kind of that initial infusion. Now, today, I definitely would not just characterize all of, you know, the new, all of innovation as not having that DNA. Tons of the traditional financial sector, folks who grew up in that sector have since moved into like really awesome innovative companies and infused a lot of startups and other cool entities with more of that DNA. But that was necessary and will continue to be necessary to get there. If you don't have that context, you don't just walk into it and succeed. You have to have that. And so if somebody asks you, well, do you think that this is necessary? They're going to say, heck no. Why would I want that? I'll just be in charge of my own thing, right? They end up blowing up their company, right? Because they didn't have that. They didn't understand that it was even necessary.
That is the nicest way I think I've heard it put. I think in the past I've said, and Carol's been there when I've said, you had a bunch of guys who were in tech who came over into fintech and wanted to pretend the thin part didn't exist. And then you see them sometimes analogize Uber. Yeah. And then they're like, well, when I was at Uber and now I'm in financial services, and I'm like, the fact that you think moving people in cars is the same as moving billions of dollars globally for pennies on the dollar anonymously, that blows my mind. But you're right. It is a mentality. I think we all know people in the space who come from the government, TradFi, some people would say the most regulated business, financial services, who then see the beauty and the possibility of the tech, see the promises, right? Which Carol, I thought you did a really good job of including in the report, like the possibilities of it and the room that it has to improve lives. if done responsibly with that mentality of, but you have to look at all parts of the equation. You can't just look at impact. You have to look at threats and probabilities and the potential for mitigation. If you move fast and break things, what if you break something that's really expensive or worse, irreplaceable?
I love the arc of the questions that you're asking, Amanda, and the story that you're telling and we're a part of telling, and Jess, also the vein that you took. It's interesting, as both of you were talking, I was thinking about, like, it's interesting how absence of trust in institutions, whether it's government or centralized financial institutions that drove to the advent of why Bitcoin was created in the first place, then led to a lot of actors who then either totally discounted because didn't find them valuable, truly weren't aware of whatever, like all the lessons learned from institutions for things like risk management and how to properly deal with, like, making sure that terrorists and cyber criminals and child exploiters and narco traffickers didn't have, like, an easy means for laundering proceeds and enabling things like the rise of sophisticated ransomware service economies. And despite, I know that there are people that certainly I testified recently and there were people that felt differently that ransomware as a service would work just as well, if not better, in TradFi. I fundamentally disagree with that for a lot of reasons. I know that ransomware existed before crypto. That does not mean that I think that ransomware as a service economies would exist in their current state and as profitably as they would if they were reliant on gift cards and wire transfers. I just do not believe that. But it is interesting seeing how, like, this moment of, like, growing digitization, which includes things like payments, but also social media and information access and the incredible economic benefits that come from it, but also compounded by and potentially, like, having a relationship with, like, the absence of trust in these giant institutions and then therefore leading a bunch of techies that now have access to this capability that, like, we're just writing some code, some speech asterisks, but not all speech is protected either. So, like speech that then turns into operations and money transmission and other things, and who either disparage or weren't aware of and didn't care to learn the requirements for how to operate successfully a business and manage the risk in this space. It is interesting how that's come around. Why I'm excited about all the, like, TradFi and traditional institutions, which have been in the tech space for a long time, as Jess spoke to, and driven tons of the innovation in this space. And now they're bringing their understanding of risk mitigation into some of these decentralized technologies and bringing that expertise. It will be really interesting to see how those sectors fuse together. I do think that we're in the middle of, like, that this wave of DeFi innovation is going to be an institutionalized wave, is how I'm seeing it.
I think you hit on something, like, super critical with the loss of trust in systems. Because going back to something that Jess said a while ago, and I love the way that she phrased it and the way that she kind of points out things that you might not see it that way, like, especially coming from certain backgrounds and kind of prying at people's biases. But when you said the way that you look at risk management and all of financial services being risk management, right? And I think when I think of, you know, we talk about the decisions that are made of cost benefit analysis of compliance and cost benefit analysis. And I mean compliance going all the way back to responsible innovation from the jump of when you're building something and even calculating, right? Like, what are the risks of regulation or enforcement actions, et cetera. I have a real problem with the fact of, like, what society has been saying to them, right? And to Carol's point, like, in terms of lack of trust in institutions, lack of trust, like, a system that says one thing and does another. I will tell you, a couple of days ago, the question that I had fundamentally is, how about we just be honest as a society that we don't care about money laundering? Because if you're going to get 25 years as a sentence for stealing from people, and you're going to get 4 months as a sentence for operating a transnational money laundering organization for years and years and years, what do you think that says in terms of risk management? Because if I was somebody opening an exchange, I'd say, wait, I make billions, maybe trillions, I get 4 months in prison. I think society just made pretty clear what the risk of money laundering is. To Jess's point, I'll have internal organizational controls and I won't steal people's money as I launder it. And I'm not saying FTX was laundering money. Let me be clear. I'm just saying, like, if you look at these two statements about what society is telling to people, if you're a human doing a risk management calculation, you are definitely probably not trusting the system. You are saying it's completely broken. And if it's completely broken, why should I have to follow rules that apparently nobody else has to follow? And if it's not fair for anyone else, shouldn't I just look after me? And I don't know that I can blame people for that.
Yeah, I'll tell you who has to follow them is the banks. Because if you look at the opposite side of just looking at the punishments and what they're required to do for the amount of money that we find that is being laundered or that is illicit finance, like the bill on the operational side of compliance of the banks is just exponentially enormous every year. Now, having been on the terrorist financing side of Treasury, I am, 100% in favor of stopping any kind of illicit finance, and it should not occur. So I am not at all arguing that we shouldn't care about this space. But I do, there is that big difference of view of the average consumer or the average person, and then the corporations where the rules definitely turn the screws on them, because that's the easier screw to turn.
Well, I will say, I know just as many bankers who looked at the HSBC fine and said that was a tiny fraction of what they made from that activity, and they're doing just fine. So I know bankers who say if the enforcement actions on the banking side were more, we'd have an easier time making an argument for more compliance investment. But if the fines are low, and to your point, Jess, if everyday compliance is a cost, and there's no clear benefit of avoiding massive enforcement actions, if I just spent $2 billion on compliance and I could have spent $1 billion and a half billion on an enforcement action, I'd have been ahead if I'd spent less on compliance and just paid my fine. And I think that's what frustrates some people.
I think it's definitely a challenging question that I'm not going to solve right now. But I think that doesn't take into account the reputational cost. Simply putting the price tag on it is not equivalent to taking into account reputational cost, additional operational cost of supervisors than, being more pickier or more attuned to that particular agency, that particular organization for a certain amount of time. There's kind of another value there that doesn't have a clear, distinct price tag on it in that way.
Yeah, I do see the problem that you guys are highlighting. And this issue, I do take extreme issue with it, because of course, I like the AML framework. I know that we need to look at and consider its efficacy and what are the right measures to drive its efficacy. Sometimes the things that industry calls for, I don't think are realistic or in full understanding of what the framework is and the requirements and why they are. But I also understand that industry points back at government and says, honestly, like they use exactly these points, Amanda, and highlight that, like, and that's why we shouldn't be asking banks to do it. That basically, like, either to remove the AML framework or to, like, certainly the re-envisioning that was in and required under the AML Act, I think driven by this recognition that things aren't working as well as we need to based on the costs for institutions, but then also, like, what is the actual outcomes? Of course, this part of my approach is saying, like, we need to fix our enforcement approach. An investigation that takes at least 6 years, as the law enforcement agents spoke to on this case, against the largest entity in the world, like, how much of an effective deterrent do we think that this was? And how much more impactful would even a smaller action have been in the space 4 years ago? What does that mean? And in fact, there's lots of law enforcement cases that I could think of right now about the duration of how long they take and when they come, whether that timing has been effective or not in achieving the outcome that you're driving for. But also, due process takes time. And so I recognize that, like, my desire for, like, more early and often enforcement, and some of this is where also civil and criminal can depart from each other and should at times, like there's times when they go together and times also when it makes sense to separate them, because is the enforcement meant to shape a sector or to break it? And I would argue that, like, not providing effective deterrence and then bringing an action, while it may be the largest one ever, even if it was way too late and they made way more than the penalty, is really creates a deterrent effect for them and for future actors. And then the negative consequences and opportunity costs that it brought to the more compliant U.S. operating or U.S. headquartered and located exchanges, what does that mean for us and competitiveness? So it certainly drives to, I think, us needing to think about enforcement and how we're taking that approach and whether it's effective. It also means we need the international community to be enforcing, because that's part of the problem, is that, like, with the banks, at least every other jurisdiction, asterisk, is regulating and enforcing against their banks to an extent. That is not the reality, no matter how many jurisdictions patted themselves on the back in the last assessment that the FATF published about everyone saying we're largely compliant. I certainly have some views on some of those, like, self-attestation assessments. But I think that that's something that we do need to consider and look at on how we can try to fix this issue.
I think one of the things that's intriguing to me about, because we have different backgrounds, but we're actually kind of similar. But I think one of the things that frustrates me is I look at what some of the other foreign countries are doing in terms of gobbling up experts and putting them in government agencies and saying, to Jess's point, the way that we've been doing this is not necessarily the best way for industry to thrive, right? We don't want terrorist financing. We don't want money laundering, but we should probably have a system that is built to combat that, that wasn't built for cash in the 70s. So what if you put brilliant minds in a room and said, we're spending billions of dollars on reports that tons of people aren't looking at? It's tons of chaff. There's very little wheat. If what you want is wheat, how do we get you wheat? Right. And I think one of the things that hurts my heart is that I talk to people like you in the United States who spent years dying to have this conversation. How do we modernize the BSA? How do we make money laundering detection and prosecution more effective? People on the industry side saying, what if we could take crypto and build a compliance tool that actually gave you actionable information that wasn't thousands of pounds of chaff to get a shred of wheat? And I think it's just really frustrating in the US to see how bogged down that's gotten and where it's not going anywhere, and to watch in smaller foreign jurisdictions that are frankly more nimble, that don't have the bureaucracy, that don't have the politics. I just really worry that that's not the thing we're competitive at. That is not where we shine. And there's so many really good people having these conversations, screaming into the wind, like, but we could get a lot of folks in a row to like do some really amazing things. Oh, if only, you know?
Yeah, I am curious to see. I read a lot of submissions and like things that people say. I will, so far, one of the biggest blue sky ideas that I've heard, which is actually the closest thing to a blue sky idea, really, that I've heard on changing AML, because
a bunch of listeners might not know what a blue sky idea is. So just explain that.
Like just like as big and creative and without potential consequences for actual implementation, like without bounds or restrictions or constraints, could we imagine? And the closest thing, like practically, that I've found, because like some ideas I find are extremely limited and minimal and like not like really game changing. The closest one, and I think that there's issues with it, but I understand why it's a game changer if you did it, is remove the prevention, remove the de-risking element entirely. Basically, inclusion of all, good and bad. Bring them into the fold. Enhance the ability for analytics on top, then you're getting all financial information inside the regulatory perimeter, and then enhance law enforcement's ability to hold accountable bad actors and detect them, because you're not driving anybody outside of the regulated financial system because everyone's inside of it. I'm like, fascinating pitch. And if AI is good enough, there's a lot of implications there. We have to scale our enforcement. It can't take 6 years in order to do that, right? Like this, like there's a huge amount of implications for like scaling other capabilities, which is why I find it actually kind of impractical. And then also on the desirability front, how do we feel about no longer having the prevention part of an AML program requirement and just having the detection and holding accountable? And the prevention is exclusively through deterrence by imposition of consequences. There's no longer deterrence by denial of access to services, essentially, like, except for, I guess, I assume criminals or something, but maybe not. Like people that pitched that were trying to address the redlining problem and then also leverage the potential capacity for really great innovative AI and other emerging tech. I actually feel that our framework isn't so bad in its policy requirement. It's about the implementation, the efficacy, and where enforcement and compliance checklists are being viewed as a checklist and not driving an accurate understanding and meaningful understanding of risk and being mitigated. And that is also what's driving automated redlining, because it's hard to get a bank account in this country if you're a Nigerian or Somali immigrant. And that's a problem. And that's because of an inability to assess risk and manage risk, as Jess messaged. So where I'm hoping that of access to other types of data and better AI capabilities and other types of emerging technologies can help us actually just address and better mitigate risk to leverage the available data in a more effective way. But what does that look like in policy changes? What does that look like in practical implementation changes? That's where I feel like the dialogue needs to be and has to sit, and where meaningful implementations of things like digital identity can help to certainly combat massive amounts of fraud that are used not just in fraud, but also in like terrorism financing and other things, that actually fixing identity fixes a lot of things in illicit finance. So
I think the thing about that suggestion that's so amazing, but also I don't want to say far-fetched, but it requires an admission of where humanity actually is. versus where it says it is that I just don't think a lot of people are willing to do. I mean, I remember being at the FATF meetings a couple of weeks ago when we were talking about the travel rule, and it was and it was actually at a different meeting like the next day because it was at the time of Paris Blockchain Week. And it was just very interesting because to your point where you were saying you had the issues with the FATF countries as a former money laundering prosecutor, you know who I would have put on the gray list first? The US and the UK, right? In terms of the amount of funds laundered. Let's start with, what is it, South Dakota or Wyoming trusts? Like, I couldn't send a subpoena to some states without them reporting to my targets that I had issued a subpoena, and it would have taken an act of Congress because there are some states in the United States that are money laundering havens that came out in Panama Papers. So, like, it's a very, like, who are we really versus who are we saying? Which I know Jess is kind of like, oh man, I do not want to get into an existential 10,000. Let's stick to tangential. And you're right, but like, at the same time, there is a very, like, underlying all of this, I think, is a very problematic. We should really be more honest about who we are versus who we say we are. And I think some people want to have that conversation with who we really are versus who we're saying we are, right? What is compliance really versus what we're saying compliance is? What is AML effectiveness versus what we're saying it is? What is KYC versus what we're saying it is? And I think that's the problem that underlies a lot of this, is that going back to the very first thing we said, definitions even require a layer of truth and honesty that sometimes I feel like we're not having when we're having these conversations.
Amanda, you've stumbled upon the great question of governance and regulations for everything. I was just thinking back to being in OMB at the White House and looking at programs where money is going to a particular program, supposedly for a particular purpose. But if you actually look at what it is doing, where it's going, and who is actually doing it, and then where that money is going, the questions that you just said about let's be honest about what this is versus what this isn't, and what we're doing versus what we're not doing, but slapping a word on top of it that sounds like it's all goodness and sunshine, but actually is something else. Or maybe there are like incredibly good intentions, but when you do try to roll back, how can that logistically happen? Things go to the left, or they go to the right, or they just go up or down, like, just, you know, not in the straightforward way that you hoped that they would. So I was just giggling to myself, thinking back to how true that is to all of governance and regulations. It's a challenge across the board, AML or not.
Well, we're probably not going to solve that problem today. The problem of the ages, going back to the invention of government and governance.
I'm so curious about how Jess will feel about this, because Jess drove a giant fintech report back in under for all of Treasury. Back when she was in, and issues like identity and inclusion and de-risk it, just everything about fintech was included in there. And this issue is core, and it's also very important, especially amongst the Democrats and where there's some tensions there, but really for anyone who's arguing about whether or not DeFi truly does drive financial inclusion, because this is a major talking point that it brings. And I would say that it depends a bit on the definition of inclusion. Like, if the inclusion is just getting access to it, absolutely. Decentralized services, like where anyone can download the Bitcoin client software and like participate in the system, lowering the barriers to entry. Absolutely. That aspect of inclusion can be driven, is being driven through DeFi. However, inclusion in services that are not safe and affordable and reliable and trustworthy and secure is not, in fact, a desirable like financial inclusion like outcome. So predatory inclusion, which is how lots of opponents of DeFi describe what DeFi sort of is bringing, and highlights like potential disparate impacts, because there's lots of metrics that highlight that marginalized populations and people of color participate in the crypto industry like at a higher rate and percentage than in TradFi ecosystems, especially when it comes to investing. That triggers a lot of big concerns if they feel like that inclusion is being matched with giant institutions that are defrauding people and stealing their money. So this goes into that, like, inclusion has to be matched with safety and security. And it's that acknowledgement and recognition, and this failure to accept accountability, and in fact, sometimes the deliberate designs to avoid it in designing decentralization, that I find problematic in DeFi. But again, depending on where you are on the spectrum of DeFi, there are institutions that are embracing that, whether it's more DeFi native things that are bringing in bankers, or banking and other giant institutions that are getting into or have been experimenting in the DeFi space that bring some of that safety and security. but it's those things that really have to come together and be embraced. It's where they're not matched, where it ends up being problematic. Jess, I'm curious what your thoughts are.
Yeah, gosh, I definitely have opinions here. I think, you know, it's really unfortunate because the word inclusion is such an important word, and inclusion is such an important goal. And it is used so often incorrectly to mask, you know, a whole bunch of activity or reasons to do something, that if you just say the word inclusion, suddenly nobody can argue with what you're talking about. And it may or may not have any benefit to inclusion whatsoever. And so I always just try to get down to what are the reasons that someone is excluded, and does this solve those reasons, like those things? Because if it does not, then using the word inclusion is garbage. And it not only is inaccurate for the purposes of what is being discussed, it is detrimental to those who do need to be included, because it is suggesting that we're solving the problem and we're not. And so anybody who is doing that and using the word to just kind of as a coverall to get to do what they want to do is having negative effects for everyone involved. And I really just don't have a lot of patience for that. I think it's something that, unfortunately, I think we see a lot in some of the digital asset space, a lot more saying, well, you know, this will benefit inclusion and whatnot. And I think to Carol's points on predatory inclusion, absolutely. I think that there are also lots of cases where people are just saying, oh, well, this will solve inclusion. And if you actually look at issues like the digital divide, or whether people actually have access to the, you know, to the internet or baseline technology that they need to get to be included, or education to, you know, like literacy around the topics, like that doesn't solve any of that. So I really wish that it was not used so inappropriately so frequently these days.
You see this actually pretty often. Like, I saw a great article, and I wish I could remember her name. I want to say Anna Jennings, but that might not be right. But she wrote this fantastic article about when people are talking about tokenization of real world assets and it improving liquidity. And I'm paraphrasing, but she basically said, you can increase liquidity where like liquidity is present, but you can't invent, like, to your point where it was like people are using, well, it'll increase liquidity. And she's like, you can increase liquidity that exists, but you can't make something illiquid more liquid, right? Just by tokenizing it. And I'm not doing like a good job of explaining it, but basically what she was saying was essentially, and I really hope I'm not bastardizing what she said, but like it was a similar point that people should just be careful when they use these terms, that they are in fact using it properly, and that you're not saying it improves inclusion, it improves liquidity. And it turns out actually the things that are required to increase or improve inclusion or liquidity are not any of the things that this addresses. It's a similar argument.
Yeah, it is. On the liquidity front, I might argue that there are markets that are not liquid today. And by tokenizing them, you can move those tokens around, or by making them liquid, you can trade things more readily that right now are just not tradable because there's, you know, I don't know, your tractor outside. You know, you can't send your tractor quickly to, you know, somebody like, you know, 10 countries over or something. So, and that's an extreme, kind of extreme example from a real world asset standpoint. But there are definitely markets that are not liquid today that by tokenizing them, you could make them, I would say, more liquid from a status that they're almost not liquid at all.
Well, I'll tell you what I hear right now is you volunteering to come back on to decrypting tokenization of real world assets, Jess Rainier.
Oh, no. Anytime, Amanda.
Well, I appreciate you guys taking the time and going over a little bit. We want to say a huge thank you to our sponsor, Bracewell LLP. To Emily Kabrowski for her invaluable technical support, and everyone listening. Positive or negative, we welcome your feedback and we hope you'll rate us online. Please let us know if you have comments, questions, or thoughts for future podcasts. For anyone who's interested in learning more about the association, our global events, or the advocacy initiatives we're working on to increase inclusion, check out our public LinkedIn page, our Twitter or Instagram pages at AWIC Global, or our webpage at www.womenincrypto.org, which is also where you can sign up and join. Jess, Carol, thank you so much for being on the podcast. Thanks to all of you for tuning in. We hope you have a wonderful week, and we hope to see you next time.